Music and Booze with Mo is produced and distributed by the Center for Culinary Culture, home of the Cocktail Collection, and is available wherever fine podcasts can be heard. The Center for Culinary Culture, telling the story of food and drink, one taste at a time. Welcome to Music and Booze with Mo. I'm Mo Herms, and I've worked in the music industry most of my life, so have met some pretty amazing musicians over the years. I also love a good cocktail, and I've encountered some really interesting bartenders as well. It seems that there's a lot of crossover, so when I can, I like to talk to musicians and bartenders about music and booze. Join us at the bar, won't you? Music and Booze with Mo is brought to you by The Mermaid, a cozy neighborhood bar with an aquatic flair in the Little Tokyo area of downtown LA. Open 7 days a week, featuring tropical cocktails and snacks, The Mermaid also has a daily happy hour from 5 to 8 p.m. Follow The Mermaid on Instagram at TheMermaidLA to hear about upcoming events and check them out at TheMermaidLA.com. Head to 428 East 2nd Street, Los Angeles, for a drink.
Do you know the way to San Jose? I've been away so long, I may go wrong and lose my way. Do you know the way to San Jose? I'm going back to find some peace of mind in San Jose. LA is a great big freeway. Put $100 down and buy a car. In a week, maybe two, they'll make you a star. Weeks turn into years, how quick they pass. And all the stars that never were are parking cars and pumping gas.
So today we find ourselves going to San Jose to visit Mary Palak, who works at Paper Plane, which is a cocktail bar that's been around for about 6 years, and along with Mary has put San Jose on the cocktail map. So join us while we chat with her about making cocktails, making them real fast, and karaoke, among other things.
A lot to your credit, you know. I mean, you're someone, you put San Jose on the map, like cocktail wise. I know there are others who helped you get there, but you are kind of the superstar in San Jose, and you've got Speed Rack wins, and you've got Bar Mania wins, and you've got like you've done like everything, and you've done it from San Jose, which is not a town that people usually think of. When they think of, you know, a cocktail thing, they always think New York or they think London. But you've made people think about San Jose, too. So that's kind of impressive.
if that is anything of my legacy, that is it. I always joke that I am the unofficial ambassador to San Jose. The city council actually gave me a commendation.
Are you kidding?
No. It's the first time the city gave a commendation to a bartender.
That's incredible.
Remember at the ceremony, they were very cute about it. They're like, it was at 8 in the morning. They're like, I'm so sorry. This is so early.
I love that they were aware of that. Oh my God, that's hilarious. Well, so to kick this thing off, I just have people introduce themselves. So tell us who you are and where you work, because you are still sort of working during this COVID time.
Sure, yeah. So my name is Mary. I grew up in the Bay Area. I was born in the Philippines, but my family has lived in the Bay Area forever. I grew up in Santa Cruz, which is further South Bay on the coast. But I moved to San Jose and started working in bars and restaurants initially to pay for school.
Yeah.
How we always get our start, right?
Yeah.
About 10, 15 years ago. And I've been bartending all over the Bay Area ever since. And I now work at a bar called Paper Plane in downtown San Jose.
Yeah. Paper Plane How long has Paper Plane been open now? Like 5 years?
I mean, during shelter in place, we celebrated our sixth anniversary. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember. I left the Bay Area in 2014, and I think you guys were opening right around that time. And I remember hearing about it, and I was like, man, now I have to, I'll go up and visit. Next time I go up and visit, I'll make a San Jose day, you know, so I can check those places out.
That's what I tell people all the time. Like, if you're coming to the Bay Area, just swing down for like a few hours.
Yeah.
It's real quick.
Yeah. Because San Francisco tends to take up all the attention. You know,
absolutely.
And Oakland's not doing so bad itself, but
Oakland's coming up. Yeah. I love Oakland.
Yeah. You know, and I lived in the East Bay for a long time. So when Oakland started getting all fancy, I was just like, hey, wait a minute. I'm not sure how I feel about this. I used to DJ at dive bars, and now if I DJ out there, it's actually fancy drinks without things floating in them, you know? So what was
you could still get that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I don't know. Is Merchants still down by the water? That was a place where I used to question what was in my glass. But when did you said you started bartending because, you know, school, whatever. So, so what is that? That was your thing. You're like, I need to make some money. I might as well do this. Or did you ease up from serving?
Well, yeah, no, I've worked in every kind of, I mean, like, it, I feel like when you're a teenager, there's two real choices for you. You're either going to work in retail or you're going to work at a restaurant.
I was retail.
And I started,
My sister was restaurant. I was retail. You're absolutely right.
I started off as a hostess, and then I was a server, and then I would do like the cocktail serving thing. And then I asked to be trained. This is like in a restaurant called The Loft in downtown San Jose. They've been around forever, for almost like 15 years too. And they had like things like they would convert into a nightclub on the weekends. Mm-hmm. And I remember I asked, because I knew where the money was. I wasn't the sucker. I knew that the money was behind the bar. So I asked to be trained first as a backup and then eventually as a bartender. And it's being a bartender in your early 20s is just like stupid fun. It's stupid fun and irresponsible.
Well, especially in a space like that, right? This is like probably a high volume. People are just partying.
It's stupid fun, stupid irresponsible. And it's like, I think back now, I'm like, where did all that money go? Because that was like, it was such a, like, being young and very, like, very independent then, it's crazy. But it also kind of stole my focus away from school. But, like, around the same time, I'd probably been doing the, like, restaurant nightclub thing for a couple years, is when San Jose first got its first, like, cocktail speakeasy bar, and that was called Single Barrel in that basement that we're trying to figure out. It was a big kind of change because we were still in that tail end of like the ultra lounge phase of bottles. We still have some places that do like the, you know, bottle service like that. But it was the first time.
I live in LA. It's still here. You're in San Jose.
I still love it.
There's lots of rich people in San Jose. They like to show off with those bottles.
But yeah, it was like the first of its kind, and it kind of it reintroduced classic cocktails to people in San Jose who, you know, had never heard of, gosh, back then, how innovative a Moscow Mule was.
Right? I know. I remember when that kind of came back too. Like, these bars that were sort of divey were like getting copper mugs, and they were just like, hey, have you ever tried this? It's my new favorite thing. It's like, these have been around.
But it was a really cool program to kind of cut my teeth in, because it was an entirely bartender choice program.
Oh.
So it forced, and I back then, this was over 10 years ago now, back then it was kind of necessary to do the consumer education bit of it. We had to really push this different idea of ordering cocktails in a different way of, so we were very limited. Like, you couldn't order a gin and tonic. You couldn't order, like a vodka soda. Mm-hmm. I remember years later, like, I had never been to Milk and Honey or Attaboy when I went there, and I found so many similarities in our spiel about introducing you to our concept. And because it was a lot more laborious in terms of, like, there was a lot more explaining we had to do. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of, like, Q&A.
It
was basically an interview to get to figure out what I was going to pick for our customers. And we were lucky that it took off. People mostly responded well to it. Obviously, there's, you know, going to be those people who are like, rules? What? I have to be quiet? What? I can't order, you know, I can't have a shot of tequila? Like, say, like, order tequila neat. It was really cool to kind of come up in cocktails in that environment, because it was like heavily focused on education and things like that, which is for the area was completely new.
Well, I mean, there's talk now on how bars like that, or say the Milk and Honey Attaboys, you know, started this movement, obviously the resurgence of craft cocktails, and that it's been around long enough and become normalized in such a way that any bar you go to, you expect to see a couple house cocktails now. Like, oh, did you guys come up with anything? It doesn't have to be crazy unique or anything, but maybe it's a daiquiri with a dash of ube in it or something, you know? People now expect to see that. So obviously you were in the early stages of that here on the West Coast. And yeah, that must have been kind of tough. Did you go from the club thing to that speakeasy thing?
Yes. So I actually worked at both. And for a little while, and then, but it was interesting because there was a very clear, like, I could feel myself feeling less satisfied with the, you know, the club and nightclub, and it was exhausting to work in that. It was fun.
It's a great job purpose. In the early 20s.
But I remember feeling like, you know, because that draw of money had taken me away from school, so I just stopped going to school. I'm like, I could do this. but when I started at SeaWorld and learning more about cocktails and diving more into education, it satisfied this other need that I had for growth and general, like, nerdiness. It was the most fun subject to learn about was, you know,
spirits, I was
going to
say
cocktails.
For you, that was, I mean, you had to go there and you probably had to educate yourself hugely because it's a very different environment than just like vodka crayons, you know, for like hours on end, like you're doing in the club scene.
Yeah. I was really lucky because we had a really strong team. I was part of the earlier team at SeaWorld. I eventually became the head bartender, but we, like I said, it was like really structured education. We had assignments, we had like topics we would go and research. And what was really cool was that I just happened to be part of a team where everyone geeked out as hard as I did.
That's
so
awesome.
And it wasn't, I don't want to call it competitiveness, but we were not trying to one up each other. Anytime we found like a little bit, I guess.
It's like, but a friendly rivalry sort of, you know, it's like, that's a work environment, especially that kind.
Anytime we found like a cool cocktail or an ingredient we'd never heard of, we immediately like texted each other, emailed each other, or, you know, we wrote research papers for the team. I like wish I was kidding, but we didn't. On spirits, just about everyone, because we just wanted, and a lot of that was motivated by the kind of guest interaction that we had, and that we wanted to be able to speak truth and to the kind of things that we were telling our guests. But it was a cool time, and it kind of set. Like I said, it satisfied this need for me to grow and educate myself, while still like being in a really fun and like creative space.
Do you have a favorite you remember from that time? A drink that you came up with, or something? A drink that you learned about maybe during that time?
Well, back then it was a lot about a. For context, when I started at that job, my drink of choice was like a vodka press, and I left that job drinking like Lafroig. So
and like some rum agricole or something.
It was a lot. But there, I mean, I think that it wasn't my favorite to make, but it was such, I think, unique back then. We used to have a Ramos Gin Fizz happy hour.
You did that as a happy hour?
Yeah, but you could only, it was literally 1 hour. It wasn't like a discount. Yeah, it was literally still just available for 1 hour. And we shook that damn drink for 8 minutes.
I was going to say, you can only make so many because...
Exactly. Yeah. I think our like max we made in that hour was like 25 because there's only two bartenders on at a time. So it's like, it was physically impossible.
Yeah.
What we ended up doing is we would like start the drink. We would get all the ingredients in the tin, do our dry shakes, do our ice, whatever. And then we'd pass it off to who, like our managers or like our table runners or whoever was on stuff. Sometimes we gave it to a guest. We're like, here, shake it.
Oh my God. Like, oh my God.
But only if they were very good friends and we trust their shake.
Yeah, just right. I was going to say. Plus it gets cold, man. It gets really cold.
That's what it was. We'd have to like interchange.
If I do it.
This is before we realized you can use a blender.
Yeah. I mean, I know there are shortcuts to it, but when I've done it, I'm like at like the 1.5 minute mark, I get like a really thin towel or something to put on my hand because put it in there and have to switch sides because I don't want it to warm up the thing either. It's, but anyway, that's
but it wasn't my favorite to make, but it was my favorite.
That's maniacal.
It was a favorite experience to create when they got their drink, when our guests, because no one had heard of a freaking Ramos gin fizz.
Yeah, so they didn't know what to expect.
And they didn't know what to expect. And there was just like this like beautiful, like tall drink with this like delicious orange Julius foam. And, you know, it got people excited about classics again. Yeah. So,
oh, that's awesome. Yeah. That's really fun. I mean, my arms are aching just thinking of that.
They were really toned back then. Eventually, with muscle memory.
I told my husband that every once in a while I'll make one in the house because I'm like, I feel like having a shake, you know, or something. And they're super delicious. They're so lovely. But I'll do it and he'll always sit there timing it. And he's just looking at me and I'm breaking into a sweat. And I'm all, this is my arm workout for today. This is arms. But so when you left Single Barrel then, that was a while ago. Where did you go after that? What was your trajectory?
Well, I was there for a long time. I was there for close to 5 years. Mm-hmm. I left and opened another concept called Mortar and Pestle. There's a few of them in the Bay Area, which is like an Indian themed bar. I wasn't there for very long. I was there for about 6 months and opened. And then I eventually worked at the Interval at Long Now in San Francisco, which was then run by my hero and idol, Jen Coolio, who makes the Small Hand Food Syrups.
I love those.
And then eventually back down, that's where I made my way to Paper Plane, where coincidentally, a lot of my team members from Single Barrel, one of my managers from Single Barrel was the owner of Paper Plane. He went on to open Paper Plane. And there was a few of my original team members there. And it was like when they all left, and I remember jumping around from a few different bars like the Interval and Mortar and Pestle, and thinking like, that's where I really want to be because those are the people that I know that I enjoy working with. Mm-hmm. And opportunity arose. I've been there for out of the six for almost five now. So that's where I ended up. That's where I've been for the past several years, and it's by far the greatest team that I've ever worked with.
Let's talk about the good times, so the before times. you've been there at Paper Plane for a while, but is it during this time that you started racking up all the competitive stuff too? Because you've got a lot of that behind you.
So, I mean, like, right when I said, like, I got my really strong foundation at Single Barrel, but there was this point where I knew I was hitting a plateau, and I started going to conferences and education weeks on my own, again, for my own, like, educational pursuits. Mm-hmm. And I discovered this whole, like, rabbit hole of events and education and opportunities.
Yeah.
So, like, one thing led to, like, I went to my first Tales in, like, 2014, and then I heard about, like, Camp
Runabout.
That's
Runabout, when I went to my first one, too.
And then I went to the...
My first Tales was also 2014, yeah. It was a fun year.
And then I went to, like...
You went to Runabout as well?
Yeah, Runamuck, and then from there you meet a ton of people and they tell you about like experience. Like I had been to Speed Rack as a attendee. I never competed, and I always wanted to do it. And my first like cabin at Camp Renamuck, there were like 5 girls who had done it in different cities. Mm-hmm. So when I applied and got in and had no idea how to train, I was really lucky that I had started building that network of other women who had done it. And they helped a lot. And then from there, I just kept doing things. And then a lot of it stemmed from, like I said, I had hit a plateau in terms of like what I thought I could teach myself. Mm-hmm. So I just started exploring. And I think that like one of my strengths and something that has always drawn me to being a bartender is I like making friends. And I love like making connections, especially for meaningful. Mm-hmm. So all these experiences would connect me with some really good friends all over the country who would introduce me to more opportunities. So mm-hmm. It's been that's a lot of people like I've talked a lot about being from San Jose and kind of gaining some of this, I guess, spotlight. And a lot of that is just because I have gone out and asked and met with people and, you know, like learned about really cool stuff that's going on.
I found out about Speed Rack when I lived in the Bay Area in the 2000s, late in the 2010s. I think it was kind of kicking off, but I heard about it because a lot of people I knew who were bar patrons in, you know, not just craft cocktail bars, but even bars like Smuggler's Cove, which is kind mm-hmm. of a combo, right? You know, it's mm-hmm. has a heavy following. People go there and get wasted, but it has amazing cocktails. You know, in those communities, people were very supportive of the bartending community. And yeah. I thought that was so great when I first heard of Speed Rack. This is something that's geared strictly towards women. You know, it's mm-hmm. like women getting up there. And that all these people from every walk of life was going to attend this and to cheer on their favorite bartenders. And I'm like, mm-hmm. if that doesn't scream community, I don't know what does, you know.
Yeah. And it's so much fun.
Yeah, and it's really wonderful that it does that. So, you know, you're also lucky to be in an area that so supports its hospitality. You know, the Bay Area is legendary for supporting their restaurants and their bars. So it's great that you were able to meet people there and do all of that. So Speed Rack, I know we've had some of our bartenders compete in that too, is this combo of you're making these drinks in the shortest amount of time. You know, there's that. And then Barmania, which is the one in Vegas, right?
It's similar in that it's speed. If any industry, older industry people recall an older competition, I won't say rolls, so like make us sound like grandpa. There was an older competition.
A previous competition.
Called Rematch. And they had one in LA too. Okay. Rematch is kind of like the bones of what Barmania is, but Barmania is also specifically a cancer charity for St. Baldrick's that Nectalia Herbs and Rye started, I don't know, like maybe like 5-6 years ago. And having already won Speed Rack and having, because I had done, I mean, you don't like, you know, I it took me 3 years to win Speed Rack. I did it over and over and over.
Wow. And was that Speed Rack overall that you won? Did you read?
No. Just the California regional. Yeah. I was in one of the national finalists, but it took me 3 years to even win the California regional. And so I had already had this very methodical training method, and that kind of, and I was supported in that because I worked at Paper Plane is a high volume bar pre-COVID. Mm-hmm. Our capacity is 250. It's like a 6,000 square foot space. It's huge.
Wow.
I had already had experience dealing with volume. And I mean, the idea of Speed Rack and even Barmania kind of always like spoke to me because it's like a working bartender's competition. Mm-hmm. It's like as if you were on the service well on a Friday and then 4 industry titans just walked into your bar. And so you still have to make drinks fast, but they have to be of the quality and caliber for those. And that's more of like a Speed Rack thing. Bar Mania is a little more lenient. It's more fun. Because it's a little more loose in terms mm-hmm. of like the quality of drinks. But like for Speed Rack, it is. And it is like brutal judging sometimes where it's like, you know, you put an extra dash of Angostura bitters in my Manhattan and mm-hmm. that's too much, or mm-hmm. you didn't shake this jungle bird enough. And these are like actual critiques I've gotten.
Yeah. I've heard about some of those critiques. Yeah. They get debatable.
yeah. Like I didn't have, in my first year, I made top eight, which is like the stage competition.
Yeah.
And I didn't put enough absinthe rinse on my Corpse Reviver. And I got docked like 15 seconds. Which is a huge deduction.
Oh, wow.
it was crazy. I remember being so upset about that. But I also did like, I was like, I look back at that year, I see the videotapes from it, and I was so messy and like crazy because I was so nervous.
Practice makes perfect, man. And that stuff is intense. It's really intense. You know, everybody's watching you. People are cheering. It's, I don't know how I couldn't do it. I commend you just for getting up on that stage.
So. My good friend, Helen Diaz, who won California the year before me, said during my first speed rack, she said this like on camera, she said it to me. She's like, speed rack is scarier than having a baby. And I'm like, what?
Yeah. We can swear on this. This is good. This is for adults. We can swear.
Yeah. I remember thinking like, what?
Well, have you done any competitions that weren't that kind of like maybe cocktail crafting? Because there are a lot of creative ones out there too. Have you dabbled in any of those?
Yeah, sure. So I did a couple of like, I did a couple of small like local ones, which are much more like, this is my cocktail. This is my story.
Yeah.
And you know, it's never like, I've never tried out for the big competitions, like Legacy or World Class or things like that. I absolutely love, and adore the people who have the talent for that. But I've always known that that's not like something that I don't think I would do very well in, because the reason I was drawn to speed rack and like, it was because I worked in a fast paced environment and it felt like the most to my actual job that I was like, I know I'm good at this, but I did one that I won and it got me a trip to France. It was the Sidecar by Merlet competition for Merlet Cognac. And, that was about 4 years ago. And, the drink I won, since we were going to talk about music, was actually called Depeche Mode.
Oh, okay. And you got to go to France, too. Did you do that on purpose?
Yeah. So I got to go to France, and my drink, I used the Merlet Creme Depeche. But it was meant to taste like grilled peaches all the mode. So it had mezcal, cognac, and cream soda.
Yum.
So with peach liqueur.
Those actually, are all things I like very much.
We ended up putting our menu at Paper Plane after it won. It did very well.
Very nice. We still have to get to the music part, right? And so I remember I had said to you, well, if you've named anything after music, bands, or songs, that's a good place to start. Yeah, totally. But you did say you have very eclectic taste in music. So if that's one, can you showcase your eclecticism, or is it all
So it's really funny because the very first concert I went to as a child, I was probably like 10 years old, was like Primus New Year's Bash with like Buckethead and Incubus and like all the Long Beach Jam. Also, it was just so random. I grew up with that side of me that liked this specific like,
and that was in Santa music. Cruz, right? Because that's
I think it was in San Francisco. I think my cousin, my older cousin, took you. There.
That's such a Bay Area lineup, though.
And then, I also grew up like as a child of 90s pop boy bands.
Oh yeah,
and like girl bands. So it was like this, but there was another drink that I didn't make it, but I named it. A lot of times some of my teammates, they know I'm great. I love naming drinks.
That's one of the hardest things to do, too.
I love it. But I pull from either music or movie references more often. One of my favorite ones is it was drink, and my teammate was like, I kind of want to name it after Spice Girls. I'm like, well, then name it after Spice Girls. And he's like, what do you mean? And I'm like, you name it Scary Sporty Baby Ginger Posh. And people loved it on our menu. People look at it and they would laugh. And they'd be like, can I have a Spice Girls drink? And I'm like, which? And I would sometimes be a dick and I'd be like, which drink? And they're like, the Scary Sporty Baby Ginger Posh. I'm like,
Oh, you named it after all five of them?
All five of them.
Oh my God. I thought maybe you did a menu and each each Spice Girl had their own drink.
Well, it just like, it didn't say what they were. It just said Scary Sporty Baby Ginger Pasta at the name of the drink.
You rattle that off so well, too. Yeah. I would trip over my tongue trying to say all five that quickly.
Because I would say it back to people, like, can I get the Spice Girl drink? I'm like, do you mean the Scary Sporty Baby Ginger Posh?
Absolutely. Well, then I have to ask, what is your favorite Spice Girl song?
Like, Wannabe was, like, my, like, girl power song when I was totally. A kid. But, Spice Up Your Life, dude. And that's, like, such a, like, that was, like, what coincided with World Cup or something.
I think so.
I think that was such a hype song.
It's very anthemic. To go back to Depeche Mode, what's your favorite Depeche Mode song? I mean, we know why you named that drink the way you named it, but you've got to have a favorite Depeche Mode song.
Damn it. Okay. I'm blanking on the name of the song, but it's
You get to sing it for us. I used to work in a record store. We made people sing all the time. They'd come in there like, what's that? Who sings that one song? It's kind of, we're like, just sing it for us.
Hold on.
See, this is the thing. I would do terrible.
I'm trying to think of like where to start in the song.
Is it Enjoy the Silence? Because you said enjoy.
Yeah, it's the words are very unnecessary.
They can only do harm. Yeah, totally. Yeah. I was like, is it the whatever wanted? Is it that song?
Yeah. Yeah, I was like, that's what I was thinking. I was like, words are very unnecessary. I'm like, well, I can't find words, right?
Yeah.
That's like, but it was really funny because like that would come on, that would play on in the bar sometimes. And we have younger bartenders.
Yeah.
And when that drink was on our menu, mm-hmm. I had people, guests, ordering, can I have the Depeche Mode? And I would get really upset about it. And my younger bartenders, too, would be like, who's Depeche Mode? And I would, every time Enjoy the Silence came on the overhead, like, this is fucking Depeche Mode. Oh, yeah, I know this song. Like, yes, of course you do.
Oh, my God. I think Depeche Mode is, like, classic rock now, so the kids should know it. They should, you know, they should know it like we had to know Led Zeppelin.
One of them asked me who Journey was, and I was really upset about that, too. Like, that's everywhere. Like, everywhere.
Well, when you were growing up in Santa Cruz, well, you said you were born in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. So I'd love to know how old were you when you came to the States?
Oh, really young. I'm a California girl. I was like two.
Yeah. So another thing, though, is my other Filipino friends, and I was surprised when you're like, no, I never really played music. I'm like, but whoa, most of my Filipino friends either had to learn to play piano or violin. How come you got away with not learning that?
I played trumpet in middle school band.
Ooh.
And my mom loved it because they like we got to go to like Disneyland and do like some competitions and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
But no, I mean, I will say this. One, I was one of many children. I was like the youngest of four. Mm-hmm. So I don't think my parents could just straight up afford violin or piano.
Yeah. You'd have to pass that instrument down.
There was one Christmas where they bought us all like toy instruments. My brother had a drum. My sister had like a player keyboard. Mm-hmm. My other sister had the guitar, but I had the mic.
Oh.
So I will say that I grew up singing.
I was going to say. Anything. So you must be a karaoke queen. Yes.
Karaoke queen is probably the best way to describe.
What's your go-to karaoke song? Everybody has one. I mean, even if you hardly ever do karaoke, everybody's got a go-to.
Depending on the mood, but almost always I Will Survive by Gloria Gaynor or Dancing Queen by ABBA. Mm-hmm.
I think you fall into the disco, huh?
But I will sometimes just go for a fucking ballad that I can't handle. By I will sing "Power of Love" and be horrible.
I was gonna say, you try to do some Mariah. You're like, watch me hit two of the four octaves that she hits.
I will attempt it. It won't be great.
You know what? That's fun though. I love it when I see people who do something that is so outside their skill set, but you do it with gusto, you know, you've got to do it like that. And then it doesn't matter because nobody can sing like that in real life. So it's not intimidating. There's something about seeing someone just going for it that's kind of fun, you know?
there's a local gay bar that's my favorite place. I say this jokingly and lovingly, but also kind of factually is what the best bar in the world. but they have karaoke on two different nights, and I would go once in a while when I get off of work, and I love it because even if you didn't hit the note or weren't as great of a singer, because some of them sound like professionals, some of these karaoke
singers.
Yeah, yeah. But even if you weren't, they would be so amped on the song you sing. Like, I think I sang Like a Prayer from Madonna.
Oh, yeah.
And the whole crowd lost it. I had drag queens dancing with me.
Yes, yes.
I was like, this is the most fun. I'm a star.
So did any of your Filipino influences make it into your drinks ever? Does that find a way there?
The same competition that competition that I won, that had the Depeche Mode, there was also a sidecar component where I had to make a sidecar variation, and that one drew directly. And that was probably the first time that I really injected like the flavors that I grew up with into cocktails. And I made a drink called a rickshaw that used kalimansi juice, which is like, if you know Filipino cuisine, we put kalimansi, which is a cross between a lime and a kumquat.
Okay.
We put that on everything. So it was a flavor I was very familiar with and grew up with. It's kind of like a bitter tangerine is what I would describe the flavor as. That drink won. And I remember, and there was a whole story about how when I was like 17, I went back to the Philippines for the first time since I was a baby and got to ride around in all these like motorcycle rickshaws and things like that. But that was kind of like a aha moment, I think, for me, because I had come from a background that was like really heavily focused on classic cocktails. Mm-hmm. You can only reinvent a Manhattan so many ways.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when I started to really kind of inject some more like Asian flavors, Filipino flavors, that's where I found one, really cool drinks that I got to make, and two, even more satisfaction in what I was doing, what I was creating.
Yeah.
Like, the Asian market's my favorite place
to
just explore. So
I live near a seafood city, which is like Filipino central. I'm like, this is where I go get my pandan leaves.
I remember when I started seeing European bartenders using pandan leaves and this was a while ago, drinks and everything. And I'm like, where did you get that?
It's like, because someone like you probably showed them. So I mean, you were talking about the education aspect when you got to Single Barrel and learning there, but and then also imparting that to your guests. But when you started doing this at, I'm guessing it was at Paper Plane, when you got to be able to start injecting the kind of Asian and Filipino things, how was that for you? I mean, you were really educating people on something that might have been way outside of their
I mean, it's been a problem. Like, the past several years, there's been a lot more, especially in, like, any kind of thing I'm creating, there's been a lot more intention behind it. Mm-hmm. And I think that when I started drawing directly from my heritage, my history, and flavors I was super familiar with, it the drinks were just, like, so much better. Like, they were just more valuable to me, so they, I cared more about how they came out. But it was also, I started connecting with a lot of other people who do the same, like my good friend Kevin Dietrich in San Francisco, who has an amazing cocktail program at Pacific Cocktail. This year we were both named, he won, but we were both in the top four for American Bartender of the Year through Tales of the Cocktail.
Yeah, I saw so that. Congratulations for that nomination. Thank you. Amazing.
So 50% of the top four bartenders of the year in America were Filipino. And that was huge. That gave me chills. So I mean, and he does some amazing. He does a whole like Pinoy heritage pop up paired with a really amazing chef, and that's what they've been doing for their to go program and their Parklet program mm-hmm. right now. So it's like getting to connect with other people who were also doing it, and it was all kind of similar timing where I was just like, oh my gosh, there's other people who are like also turning to this really specific cuisine that doesn't, I mean, like, of all, I think it doesn't, it's not considered like a fancy food. It's not considered like,
it doesn't come cuisine. To mind right away, like Italian mm-hmm. or Mexican does.
Exactly.
You know, but it isn't,
or even like Chinese foreign. Or Japanese food. Like yeah. even when you turn to Asian foods, like, you know what Japanese food is, you know what Chinese food is, mm-hmm. but a lot of people don't know what Filipino food is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it was like, it was cool that I found this also extended community that spoke to another part of my identity, not just mm-hmm. bartender.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, I had my family is Colombian, and I remember some years ago, I always bring it up. Like every other podcast I have, my family's Colombian. It's something I grew up with, even though I was not born there. But my mom was, and she, you know, came mm-hmm. here, and we hung out with tons of Colombians, and we ate Colombian food, and, you know, mm-hmm. the aguardiente, not so great. Lulo, really great.
Well, I was just going to say, we have one of my coworkers and dear friends is Colombian, and he introduced us to Lulo.
Lulo is the best. It's impossible for me to find the pulp around here, but yeah. So shockingly, I mean, I used to find it a lot more in San Francisco than I do here in Los Angeles, but it's out there, but it's delicious. It's so, I always try to tell people, what's it like? I'm all, it's kind of like an orange and a tomato. I'm not really sure how to, it's got.
That's a great description.
Like, it's like a cross with that. But someone asked me once, they said, you know, you bring this up, but you weren't born there. You're not actually like a Colombian native. So why do you claim that culture, even though you're born and raised in San Diego? Like, this is someone who just was curious. They weren't being like a dick or anything. They just were like, you know, what is it, since you didn't actually grow up there in that country, then what does that make you? I'm like, well, I think I love showing people what it's like somewhere else. And there are mm-hmm. things I know about that you might like, you know, like I can make you lentils my style and you might be like, these are the most delicious lentils. And I'm like, this is how they do it in Colombia. And these are the things they put in it. So it's kind mm-hmm. of like, you know, like pandan and ube. Those are two flavors mm-hmm. that I've learned from my Filipino people. You know, mm-hmm. I didn't know about those flavors till they started popping up. And that is because of the Filipino influence. And, you know, also, since I have loved tiki and tropical for such a long time, it was great to learn how tiki in this country wouldn't exist were it not for Filipinos. I mean, more or less, you know, they were kind of the ones that came up with all the syrups and all of this. So we all have a lot to learn from each other. And I think that's amazing. Everyone's experiences count into it. So I love that you're having that experience, bringing mm-hmm. what you grew up with to people and they're loving it. And it's,
yeah. And I think sharing. It's also like, It's almost like when you talk about, like, especially children of immigrants or immigrants, or descent,
which we are.
It's like there is almost this like responsibility to our ancestors mm-hmm. to keep that story relevant.
I think so.
And I think about that. Yeah, I think like I was really lucky. I grew up in a lot of like community organizations that were geared towards like teaching new generations like mm-hmm. Filipino culture. So I grew up doing the dances. Mm-hmm, and,
mm-hmm. My mom like, taught the dances. Dad. So same. I grew up with the same kind of thing. Yeah.
So I think it's like, that's an important identity. And it's not so, it's even if like, I mean, like I have like nieces and nephews and like, and that were born here and, you know, I think it's still going to be important for them to keep preserving that identity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's what I think it's what makes where we live as this country struggles with its identity. I think the melting pot ideal is what mm-hmm. makes it so interesting because it's not like mm-hmm. that in a lot of other places. So I think we have to work as hard as we can to keep that whole idea going, you know. Mm-hmm. I have a question for you about your chill out time. If you are not working, if you're home, just kind of hanging out, what are you drinking and what are you listening to?
I have recently discovered like lo-fi music. I just went back to school.
Oh.
During this. I mean, mm-hmm. why not? Because, you know, if you weren't working, why not go back to school? But I needed like music to kind of hone in and focus. And my friends, I grew up watching like the like Studio Ghibli animation movies.
Oh, yeah.
They're very like ethereal and very like, you know, like dreamlike.
They're so
and
beautiful.
She introduced me to this like YouTube channel where it's just lo-fi music, but it's lo-fi music from Ghibli movies. And that has been like, it's so
I'm
going to
ask you for that link later.
It's so soothing and it's, so if I'm at home, I'm just kind of like doing homework or kind of chilling out, reading or things like that. More often than not, it's like a low proof, like martini, kind of bamboo, like sherry vermouth situation, and I'm listening to like lo-fi on TV. But,
lo-fi Studio Ghibli.
lo-fi TV is such a random thing. You know? But, like,
I love it.
But like when I'm like at home and I'm kind of like more active, like I'm working out, I am. Yeah. I have like. Like what's in my in my car at all times now is like reggaeton. There's like a reggaeton station on Apple Music that it's just on all the time. That I've basically been playing like nonstop since I last went to Puerto Rico last year. Mm-hmm. So it's just been there.
Amazing. Amazing.
I've also really because I deep dove into like TikTok like for a few months.
Yeah.
I am obsessed with like K-pop and like Blackpink. Well, it's not even like K-pop in general is super dope, but like Blackpink, I can't get enough of them.
Yeah,
they're so cool.
It's like I think I first heard them because they had like some video they released on YouTube like 2 years ago. Like the day it was released had something like 18 million views, and I'm all, wow, I feel really out of sorts that I've never heard of this band before.
I knew my nieces are total Kate, like, which is appropriate for their children, teenagers. They were super into K-pop and they have like, they're part of like the BTS army or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, what is this mess? I don't know. But I like would hear, as in, I was like scrolling on like TikTok or social media and then all of a sudden like Blackpink came on. I'm like, what is this? This is freaking awesome.
Right. And I grew up in the 80s, so mine was Duran Duran. I'm a devout follower of boy bands. So I when I realized that Duran Duran was essentially a boy band, I don't think they need to be manufactured like the Monkees or like whatever the 90s one, NSYNC or those guys. But there's a reason for that stuff, and girls always love boy bands. So whenever there's a new boy band, K-pop included and everything, or K-pop, J-pop, whatever, I have to listen and I have to look because I need to judge them for myself and I have to figure out which one is the cute one for me because it's not a boy band unless one of them is cute to you.
That same year where I went to like Primus Buckhead, like that first concert, my second concert was NSYNC and I cried.
Oh my God, that's amazing. Amazing. I love that. So I wanted to wrap this up a little bit because we've been talking for a while, which I love. Thank you. And see if there are ways that, if people want to follow you on the Instagram or to support Paper Plane in any way. I don't know if there are any options like that at this time. Any of that info you want to throw out?
You can follow us both. My IG handle is at Mixtress Mary.
Mixtress Mary. Nice. Yeah,
and Paper Planes is at Paper Plane SJC. Mm-hmm. They're in a regrouping phase right now. So we're contemplating whether it's going to be a to-go, whether it's going to be a patio. So whatever phase will be, I know we'll be back. I think, so we'll be back soon, hopefully. That's pretty much where you can find me.
So if you jump on it,
it's the same. If you're following me on TikTok, it's the same.
Is it Mixtress Mary on TikTok too?
Yeah, I actually did. I did some creative. I was a TikTok creator. That's why I dove deep into it. I did like some really basic spirits knowledge and cocktail videos there.
Just on TikTok? You didn't do any Instagram ones or anything?
No.
Just kept it there.
I was a little nervous about sharing my TikToks.
But now.
I felt like so out of place in this very Gen Z platform.
Well, you do plenty of online presentations too. I've noticed that bouncing around.
Tomorrow I'm doing one on Portland Cocktail Week, and it's coincidentally enough named after another song, Free Fallen. It's on Freefloor.
Oh,
so I named it after the Tom Petty song.
There you go.
It's called Free. It's the title of the course is called Free Phone.
Yeah, so if people follow at Mixtress Mary on Instagram, then mm-hmm. they would be alerted to if you're going to do anything else like that, if you're going to pop up online and do anything like that. Well, okay, that sounds awesome. Don't go away. I'm going to turn this off, but thank you so much for all of this. I appreciate it. Many, many thanks to Mary for sitting down and chatting with me, taking some time out of her day. Again, if you want to follow Mary on the Instagram, it's at Mixtress Mary. And if you want to follow Paper Plane and see how they are doing during this crazy time when things are open and closed and partially open and you want to maybe support, look up Paper Plane SJC on the Instagram and look them up online, because there might be a way you can help out during this crazy time. I'm thinking gift cards for your friends that live in the area if you don't, stuff like that. And again, as always, thanks for listening, and make sure you check out Mary's playlist. It's a fun one. You can find the link on the Facebook page and on the Podomatic page, Music and Booze with Mo, podomatic.com. Music and Booze with Mo is brought to you by Barkeeper, a head shop for cocktail lovers, located at 614 North Hoover Street in Silver Lake, Los Angeles. Stop by for barware, vintage glassware, a carefully curated collection of spirits, and one of the most impressive selections of bitters anywhere. Follow them on Instagram and Facebook for information regarding spirits tastings. That's barkeepersilverlake.com. And also in the Virgil Village neighborhood of Silver Lake, Los Angeles. Thank you for tuning in to our barroom chats on Music and Booze with Mo. For more info about today's guest, or if you want to connect with me, check out my Facebook page, Mo Herms. Please subscribe to the podcast and feel free to tell all your friends about it. While you're there, give the show a rating and a review. It really helps to get the word out. If you want to hear the playlists our guests have curated, search SheBMO on Spotify, SHEBMO. Find pictures of the interviewees and the cool stuff they create on the Music and Booze with Mo Instagram account. Lower your expectations and join us at the bar. Till next time, cheers.